Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. Well, the political chaos in France continues, though, maybe at a slightly lower fever pitch now that we have a new prime minister, François Bayrou.
Yeah, new is a bit of a big word, Sarah. Bayrou is not exactly a newbie, 73 years old. I don't want to sound ageist, but still. He's a former education minister from the centre-right Modem party, which he founded in 2007. And in that same year, he came in third place in the presidential election.
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, he's a well-respected politician, seen as a free thinker, though he did have a run-in with Brussels over party funding, not the first to do so.
No. Modem, his party, is allied to the centrist coalition that allowed Emmanuel Macron to get re-elected in 2022. And Bayrou has always supported Macron, but of late, relations have become a bit strained to the point where it's rumoured that Macron didn't actually want Bayrou to be prime minister. But Bayrou stamped his foot, pulled his strings and got his way. And so now he's kind of showing that he's not completely a Macron lackey.
And since he was named, Bayrou has been busy trying to form a government, hopefully a bit more stable than the last one, which lasted only 3 months.
But he's already under fire. He committed a bit of a faux pas over the weekend. Rather than heading to the French overseas territory of Mayotte, which has suffered a devastating cyclone, hundreds of people are reported dead, he chose to head back to his hometown of Pau, where he's still mayor, for what was, well, basically a town council meeting. And the subject under discussion was whether you should or not be allowed to keep being mayor when you hold a position in government.
Yeah, for example, like prime minister. Bayrou, of course, is in favor, even if Macron has encouraged his ministers not to hold two posts at the same time, which actually is legal in France.
Macron, meanwhile, has stepped back into the spotlight. He's headed to Mayotte today, Thursday, travelling with much-needed humanitarian aid.
Yeah, 4 tons of it. The island is desperately in need of bottled water and food, as well as lots of help to rebuild the hospital, rebuild schools, and of course, housing.
Macron isn't quite sure what's awaiting him. It's the first time he's been there since 2019, when he famously promised a massive investment plan for the island, because this is France's poorest department. That funding, however, never came. And in the June parliamentary elections, the far-right National Rally kind of reaped the rewards of all that, came out on top with more than 54% of the vote.
So, Allison, it's always a little tricky displaying other countries or other cultures' art and artifacts.
Yeah, there is this issue of how they got there in the first place, like art that was taken during the colonial period. Some of it, well, it's now being returned.
Yeah. And then there's the question of how you name things. And of course, naming is political. In the past few months, that has become very obvious with objects from Tibet shown in French museums, notably the Musée Guimet, Paris's Asian art museum. The museum's Nepal-Tibet collection is now called Art from the Himalayan World. For Tibet scholars and Tibetans, there are about 20,000 Tibetan exiles living in France. There's a concern about erasing the word Tibet, and there are some questions as to why this is happening.
We supposed to be in a democratic country. We are being put aside, neglected, denigrated by an institution, guardian of arts, of preserving truth, and showcasing history the way it was, and yet here they are erasing our name.
Tenzin Wosur is one of 60 or so people who've gathered on a sidewalk across the street from the imposing building of the Musée Guimet, Paris's Asian art museum. They're wrapped in Tibetan flags and they're holding signs. The Students for a Free Tibet France has been holding demonstrations like this every week for 3 months now, after they learned that the museum had changed its Nepal-Tibet collection, renaming it Himalayan World.
Nous sommes les Tibet.
Yang Chen, the group's president, shouts into a microphone, leading the group in chants, shouting towards the museum. Tibetan art deserves its real name, the crowd shouts.
Pour nous, c'est très, très symbolique.
It's very symbolic, she says, to see the name Tibet be erased. It's very disappointing. I was really shocked, angry, very sad, because I thought this was a free country. Chinese pressure has arrived even in France. Yang Chen and most of the others at the gathering are not regular visitors to the museum. The name change came to their attention when the Tibet scholar Katia Bouffetril noticed the use of the Chinese term Xijiang to describe Tibetan objects in the catalog of another museum, the Quai Branly. This was in March of this year.
I saw also that in Musée Guimet, the name was Himalayan World, no more Tibet. So we did with a group of researchers an open letter, and after a lot of media, decided to take this issue.
France Info Radio did an investigation into the museum's backers and funders and concluded that the changes were very likely due to pressure from China, which rules Tibet as an autonomous territory.
After we started, and other people also, to inquire and to speak with people inside Quai Branly, and, well, I understood that it was done under the pressure of the Chinese embassy.
The Quai Branly eventually changed the names back to Tibet. But the Guimet Museum, which has one of the world's largest Asian art collections outside of Asia, has stuck to its term Himalayan World. Its director, Yannick Lintz, has said the term is used in other institutions. But Bouffetril points out that the name was changed this year, coinciding with the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of Franco-Chinese relations and the visit to Paris of Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
They changed the name to Himalayan World in February, the room of what was called Tibet-Nepal. And the problem is that Tibet is not Himalayan World. The Himalayan World is countries like Nepal, Bhutan, Laos, which is the south range of Tibet. But Tibet is something of 2,500,000 kilometers, and it doesn't belong to the Himalayan world. And it was done at a time when the museum is doing the commemoration of the 60 year of the Sino-French relationship. I'm not in the secret of the people, but, you know, you had this coincidence that the change occurred just before Xi Jinping coming. And we all know that Xi Jinping doesn't want to see Tibet. So let's say that there was a coincidence.
This whole change from Tibet to Himalayan world, you know, Tibet experts are not happy about it. Tibetans who are first to be concerned about these things are not happy about it. French people are confused by this. So in the end, who benefits from these changes? The only one who's happy is China. And that's why, you know, I ask these questions.
Tenam is a Tibetan activist who's been in France since 2005. He remembers going to the Guimet Museum years ago to see some of their Tibetan objects, some that date back 400 or 500 years.
The things that I saw, the tanka or the religious scrolls that I saw, the statues that I saw, I felt like, okay, I have to remove my shoes to continue my visit, because for me that was like such a sacred space. So to see the influence of China reaching these sacred spaces for Tibetans, it was kind of a shock.
He found out about the name changes from the op-ed signed by Bouffetril and others. He and other Tibetans wrote letters to the museum asking for a meeting with director Yannick Lintz. They got no answer. Their letter to the French president did get a response. It told them that this was an issue to take up with the culture ministry. The foreign ministry confirmed that France still officially uses the word Tibet and not Xijiang. But with no answer from the Guimet Museum, they decided to protest.
It's not just about protest. We are also there singing, dancing, you know, saying like, yeah, this is also us, Tibetans. It's about not being forgotten. We are Tibetans. We are the first who is concerned by these changes, because what she is changing us, you know, changing our history and changing our identity, which is facing such a danger inside Tibet today. You know, everything, especially since Xi Jinping took power, there is like less and less space for Tibetans to learn the Tibetan language, to learn Tibetan culture, to be a Tibetan.
Indeed, Tibetans in Tibet are blocked off from the rest of the world. Children are taught Chinese and are being separated from their culture. Renaming Tibet is part of the attempt to erase their identity.
There was a time when China wanted to say, like, oh, you should change the name of, you know, the famous comic Tintin in Tibet to Tintin in China's Tibet. You know, we laughed about it. That was like maybe 10, 15 years back. And China has always tried to sort of, you know, rename Tibetan spaces. But this is something not new, right? Colonial powers have always done that. They always try to give their own name. So renaming, for me, it is an act of, like, you know, removing the indigenous space. It's about ownership. And this is what China has done by renaming, like, in Tibet into Xizang.
Tinham says that this is more than just labels in a museum.
So it is not about one museum. This is the first instance, you know, in a democratic nation. And if we are not able to stop it here, then it might be too late, you know. There is this Tibetan saying, like, you know, you have to build the dig before the flood comes, you know. And I think this is what it is about.
Tenam is surprised that this is happening in France.
One thing I've seen in France is there's these two way of labeling stuff, right? AOC and AOP.
Right, this is for food,
yeah,
and for wine.
Food for wine and appellation d'origine contrôlée, origine protégée. So I live in a country where food, the origin, le terroir, is so important. You know, the distinctness of each valley and each region is celebrated, you know, is protected. And a museum in a country like that doesn't even blink an eye or doesn't even discuss with Tibetans, with Tibetan expert, to change the name of a country, of a population, of a civilization. I find it very, very strange.
At the demonstration, many participants are very young, shy to talk. They're holding signs that say naming is existing. For Yang Chen, who grew up in France and has always spoken Tibetan at home, the museum is an important symbol. This museum is very important because you don't see this kind of art very much, she says. To see the name of my country in a cultural institution represents not only Tibetan art, but also the entire Tibetan people.
So, Sarah, has there been any reaction to these demonstrations?
Well, there's been no response from the museum so far. The director has spoken in the press. She called the pressure from China fake news. Some neighbors have complained about the weekly protests, apparently. The demonstrators have told them to go tell the museum to change the signs and they'll stop. And the demonstrators also say that they've gotten some support from museum workers, off the record, though, of course.
And is this kind of problem only happening in France?
Well, Yannick Lintz, the Guimet director, says that the use of Himalayan world is actually common in museums. It is used in the Met Museum in New York, for example. But there, Tibet is clearly marked as a geographical area as well. The Smithsonian in Washington uses the name Tibet. The British Museum has used Tibet or Xinjiang Autonomous Region in an exhibit about the Silk Road, and this has caused some controversy. But removing Tibet completely seems to be only happening here in France so far, and more specifically in this museum. The mixed messages from the foreign ministry and the museum, which is publicly funded, makes it a bit hard to understand what's really going on. And of course, amidst France's government chaos, it's hard to know if there's even a culture ministry to ask to clarify the situation. So, Allison, as we said at the top of the show, the French department of Mayotte was hit with a terrible cyclone last week. It's still unclear how many people are dead.
Yes, Chido, this tropical cyclone, is just the latest calamity to hit the island, which has gone through a lot of upheaval in recent years.
Yeah, Mayotte is an island, right, in the Indian Ocean. It's part of the Comoros group of islands. It's between Madagascar and the African mainland. It's 8,000 kilometers from Paris and France's poorest department. has massive immigration. About 100,000 undocumented migrants live in Mayotte, and the population's only about 300,000 people.
And this is largely due to the rather complex history about how the island became a department in the first place.
Yeah, indeed. France colonized the islands, all of them, back in 1843, setting up big sugar plantations. By the early 1900s, France had formally annexed the entire archipelago. It became a French overseas territory in 1946. But on December 22nd, 1974, so 50 years ago this week, people voted overwhelmingly yes in an independence referendum. Mm. So 94.57% of votes cast were in favor of independence. The few no's were cast in Mayotte.
And this is where it all gets a bit complicated, because while the Comorian legislature declared independence of all the islands on the 6th of July 1975, after that referendum, France only recognised the independence of three of those four main islands, of Grande Comore, Anjouan and Moélie. That was on the 31st of December 1975. There was no mention of Mayotte.
Yeah, they said if Mayotte wants to be French, let's let it. Hmm. And so another referendum, this one in February 1976, asking if Mayotte should remain part of the Comoros, and the answer was overwhelmingly no.
So Mayotte stayed part of France, and in 2011 it became the 101st department. But it's remained very, very different from the mainland. Mayotte is the poorest part of France. People have lower incomes there, lower literacy rates, and also worse health.
Yeah, at the same time, its population is growing faster than anywhere else, partly because of the high birth rate, but also because of immigration, mostly from the Comoros, and also people from mainland Africa trying to reach the nearby French outpost.
And this has, of course, put a huge strain on already scarce resources. Mayotte's French inhabitants have become very frustrated, and this has translated into frequent and sometimes violent unrest. Much of it has been directed against immigrants.
Yeah, and this helps explain the high result, of course, of the anti-immigration far-right national rally during the elections. So the French government has tried to address concerns about poverty, about migration, gang violence, mostly by tightening immigration controls and changing the rules.
And into all of this comes Chido. The cyclone has exposed, you know, major underinvestment in infrastructure and public services over the years. The current situation has also reignited debate over whether the referendum back in the early 70s that led to one former French colony getting independence while the other remained French was in fact such a good idea.
Yeah, and the United Nations at the time opposed that 1976 referendum that asked Mayotte if it wanted to stay part of the Comoros. Mm. It questioned the wisdom of having two far-flung neighbors, one part of France and the other not.
Sarah, Paris and its region have, well, their own beer, their own wine, even their own cheese, and now their own olive oil.
Oh, olive oil. Wow, it doesn't seem like quite the right climate or geography for olive trees. I mean, we're not really Mediterranean around here.
We are certainly not. But it turns out that olive trees can grow pretty much anywhere. And there are many of them just down the road from here in the town of Malakoff. It's a bit like a village. It's got lots, still got lots of houses and gardens. One of its local residents, Vincent Chevrier, who has an olive tree in his garden, has gathered together local people to make the very first olive oil in this part of the country. And as I found out, it isn't just about olive oil. A Saturday morning in November in Malakoff, and Vincent Chevrier is combing through the branches of Geraldine's olive tree with an electric rake. The tree in her south-facing front garden is lovely to look at, but it hasn't produced a bumper crop. The odd small green olive falls to the ground. But it's not the quantity that counts. It's the first time she's harvested and she's enjoying it.
Très sympa, Vincent a sonné chez nous.
Vincent rang our doorbell after spotting the olive tree in our garden. I'm starting from scratch. I don't know anything, but it's great fun to try. It's the first time we've been so organized, thanks to Vincent. And we're also learning to look after the tree. It's all a bit magical to think you're going to make olive oil like this.
Vincent Chevrier has his own olive tree and launched the Malakoff Olive Initiative after realising that, well, you can't do much with one tree on your own. You need to club together.
Lots of people are just like me, you know, they have an olive tree in their garden. Every year they see the olives that fall down and serve to nothing because we don't have a mill, so we cannot process them here in Paris.
He went around the area looking for olive trees in private gardens and identified around 120 on a 2 kilometre area, mainly belonging to individuals, but also in local parks. After setting up a Facebook page to incite olive tree owners to come forward, a group of them launched a crowdfunding project to raise funds to buy equipment, an electric fork for harvesting, large nets, an olive grinder, and most importantly, a press.
So the fact of bringing it up, uniting people to buy the equipment that we need to crush, to press, and to transform the olives in olive oil, just ended to the fact that everybody jumped on the boat.
Vincent, we just don't think about olives in the north of France or in Paris. We immediately think of the Mediterranean.
You know, olive trees is a tree that you can plant in very arid climate with slopes, with very little soil. And that's why it was adapted to the Mediterranean climate. But if you put it in the north of France on a very rich soil, it could be even better. It's just that in the past, the land was dedicated to other crops. But of course you can grow olive trees and they give a lot of fruits because they are well fed. Olive trees, just like vines, do need water. The more water they have, the more fruits they produce. Nowadays, you can perfectly plant an olive tree wherever you are around Paris and have a very successful olive production.
Catherine and Michel, a retired couple, planted their olive tree 20 years ago when they came to live in Malakoff. It's big and heavy with fruit.
On ira côte à la main, une par une.
We usually pick them by hand, one by one. It's very physical. And then my husband puts them in brine. It's all well and good, but I don't actually like olives. I never eat them. I use olive oil for cooking, mainly from Greece, and now I'll be able to use homemade oil.
Olives are raining down here. I nearly just got one on my head. Vincent is having a ball, pulling the rake through the huge branches of Catherine's tree. The little green jewels fall on a large net that they've spread out in the garden.
Voilà.
Vincent weighs the crop.
10 kilos, tu vois, ça y est.
How much?
10. 10 kilograms. Okay. Wow, with leaves.
He then heads off, leaving instructions to put the olives into the freezer until everyone has finished harvesting and they can move on to the collective pressing.
Allez, moi j'y vais parce que là, il faut vraiment que je dépose. Allez. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
A month later, it's time to transform the fruit into oil at the urban farm in the heart of Malakoff.
Processing olives to make olive oil is a very dirty job. So we really needed to have a dedicated space to perform this task.
In the end, how many kilos did you manage to harvest?
We think that we will gather between 700 and 900 kilos. So it's quite a big harvest. Mm.
So in fact, this initiative has really inspired people.
It has spread very fast. Yeah.
Out on the forecourt, Geraldine is pouring cups of olives into a grinder. Once they're crushed, the sludgy, coloured paste drops into a metal canister. The paste is then tipped into a big saucepan. Philippe is painstakingly mixing it over a gentle heat, between 24 to 27 degrees, to help release the oil. It's a bit long, a bit tiring. You've got to be patient, he says. But it's definitely worth the effort.
Okay.
And did you bring your own olives here today?
Oui, oui, oui. Bien sûr. J'ai ramené les olives du quartier.
Yeah, I brought olives from my neighbourhood after helping with the harvesting. Around 16 kilos were from my olive tree and around 70 kilos from the others. A good amount. Enough to make around 7 litres of oil.
Don't come and try it.
Okay. So here we're in the headquarters. Yeah. Bonjour. Inside this big wooden chalet, people are taking it in turns to operate the olive press that the collective bought thanks to the crowdfunding. They're using a very basic traditional method. Rodriguez spreads out spoonfuls of paste onto wicker-type mats known as courtins, which act like filters. He layers around a dozen of them, one on top of the other. Then, using a kind of crank, the mats are squeezed until gradually the oil and juice trickles down into a jerry can, leaving the solid olive pulp behind.
You know here, you see little balls?
The bubbles.
Yeah, that's the oil that begins to come. The more you press, the more bubbles you will have, and that's the oil. And so we've got this big tank here, which is used to get the product of this pressing, but also is designed to separate slowly, to decant, everything that is the dirt, what goes to the bottom, and the water, and then you've got the oil at the top.
Because oil is lighter than water.
So it's a bit long to get this. Monsieur, vous voulez essayer?
So Marion is here. She's just helping out with the olive pressing. She's 7 years old. And do you have olive trees in your garden?
Oui, j'en ai un. Pour la récolte, on a eu 7 kilos, je dirais.
So you've got an olive tree at home and you managed to harvest 7 kilos. And so you brought them here to the farm?
Mm-hmm. Un peu fruité. Le goût du fruit qui est très bon.
So Marion says that this olive oil has a bit of a fruity taste. Throughout the day, a stream of people bring in large bags of olives of all shapes, sizes and colours. Some of them are not locals. Guillaume Vance travelled around 10 kilometres to come here.
We are bringing some olives from 14 to 15 inhabitants of La Garenne. So we are bringing here today a bit more than 80 kilograms. 80, yeah.
Okay, you want to taste now?
Yeah, I do. Oh, obviously.
Please take a piece of his nice bread.
Okay, dip it in this bowl of olive oil, which is...
See the nice colour?
Lovely yellow colour. A bit green. I mean, it doesn't get any fresher than this.
No, and here it's not filtered. So no. It's a pure, natural,
cold
organic
pressed
product.
Yeah. Here we go. Disgusting. No, seriously? I love it. Absolutely no bitterness.
With a hint of acidity, which is very pleasant. And it's the result of all the olives. You saw the incredible variety of olives that we've got. Yeah. Perhaps something like 30 or 40 variety, all colors of maturity, and the result is very pleasing, I think.
It is. It's very satisfying for you.
We are happy just to have oil, but good point, it's good.
It turns out the olive oil I've just tasted is one that Vincent had made earlier.
I made some tests in my basement, you know, just trying and failing. But I could produce some first bottles of olive oil so that I can know how this works, because I never produced olive oil before. So it was really a first try. Now I can train people.
And so what was the hardest thing that you discovered?
Every step, every procedure has its difficulties. Now it seems quite easy because I know the tricks. But even for, you know, crushing, you know, olives, when you don't set correctly, you know, the intensity of crushing, you know, the nuts of the olives just block the machine. Every time you've got a problem, you are looking for a solution to minimize labor, pain, and increase efficiency so that it's not painful to people. Because if it's painful, they will just not do it.
So have you tried the olive oil?
Yeah, I love it.
Can I have your name?
Yeah, I'm Joanna. And it's people, like he was saying, it's just people from everywhere in town. And they just kind of got together and decided to have this collective project. And I think it creates links between people locally in a different way than just consumption does.
Even though it's very nice to consume the olive oil when it's made.
It's a different type of consumption because you're consuming something that you made together with your neighbors, and that's what I love about it.
Okay, Alison, so can we buy any of this olive oil anywhere?
Alas, no. It'll all be distributed to the olive growers and the people that contributed to the fundraising operation. But there is a plan to start pruning the trees, which should increase production. And some of the other towns in the area that also have olive trees are keen to learn from this experience and make their own oil. So who knows, there might be more next year. By the way, this olive oil is called Born to be Oliva, which is a play on words on the disco hit song Born to be Alive by Patrick Hernandez. Born to be alive. Born to be alive. You see before. Born to be alive. We've come to the end of the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. And this episode was mixed by Adrien Toureau.
If you want to send us a message, write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We're also on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
This was our last show of 2024. But we will be back in the new year. In mid-January. In the meantime, why don't you check out some previous episodes on rfienglish.com.
You can also find us on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or your podcast app of choice. And while you're there, please subscribe and consider rating and reviewing the show. We'd love to hear what you think. Alison, see you next year. Bye.
Bye-bye, Sarah. Bye.